I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
This is Barry Truths. I'm Hank Klibanoff. The first day of the Ahmaud Arbery trial has just concluded. The trial is being held in the majestic Glenn County Courthouse in coastal Brunswick, Georgia. But banish any images that you may have of Gregory Peck, To Kill a Mockingbird, or high-ceilinged courtrooms with open windows and overhead fans. Visually, this courtroom, with dark stained paneling everywhere and no windows, could be anywhere in America. I'm talking with Lisa Hagen, the reporter for WABE, who is covering the trial. By the way, Lisa was part of this year's Pulitzer Prize-winning podcast, No Compromise. We're talking over Zoom. Lisa has just been through an eventful, long first day, starting with opening statements from prosecutor Linda Donikoski and defense attorneys Bob Rubin and Frank Hoag. Lisa, today, opening arguments. What did you hear?
Yeah, so, you know, Linda Donikoski, the prosecutor with the state, went first. Her sort of main thesis was that at every moment of decision that the defendants took, they made the worst possible assumptions about who Ahmaud Arbery was and what he was doing there. And basically made the argument that, you know, that was not warranted. They didn't witness him committing a crime. They didn't know that this guy had, you know, they really didn't know anything about Arbery himself and what he was doing there. And she, you know, she described the sort of chasing of Ahmaud Arbery around the neighborhood and described that as being under attack by three men and their cars and their weapons. And she basically tried to debunk the idea that this was self-defense. They went out of their way to get involved. They didn't call the police right away. And they're not police officers.
You know, it was interesting also in the opening argument for Donikoski, she did use some of their own words against them. Greg McMichael apparently saying at some point in that first day, you know, that speaking of Arbery, he was trapped like a rat, which just kind of rocked me back in my chair a little bit. And that there were certain things that they didn't say on that day, you know, that later they'd said, which... they, you know, self-defense and things like that.
Entire concept of citizen's arrest. Yeah, those words were not spoken that day. Yeah,
that's right. So, you know, and yet we also know that at least when it comes to Roddy Bryan's thing, comment that we heard about during the preliminary, that he quoted Travis McMichael as saying, referring to Arbery as an effing N-word.
Hard R, I believe.
Right, that's right. Living when he's on the ground, still maybe alive and dying. So they've all refined their positions as they've moved toward trial. And I imagine each will challenge the other on that as they go forward.
And then, of course, we heard from the defense side, and the first person to speak was Bob Rubin, who represents Travis McMichael, and he told a very, very different story of what had happened. And we heard from him that this is a case for their team about duty and responsibility to neighborhood and community, and, you know, sort of described, took great pains to describe Travis McMichael's experience in the Coast Guard, and that he had had some form of law enforcement training and was actually a trainer himself. And I think we're going to hear that a lot through the case, you know, sort of trying to equate the McMichaels to police officers, which, you know, often in cases like this, when police are involved, there's a lot of benefit of the doubt given to police officers about fear for their lives, et cetera. Whether or not that's going to work with the jury, I think is interesting, but we're certainly seeing those lines drawn right away. Another thing that we heard was, we heard a different story being told about the neighborhood and sort of, you know, posts on sites like Nextdoor, the neighborhood Facebook group, where people had been discussing, you know, supposed crimes in the area. And certainly we heard about Larry English, this man who owned the construction site that's at the heart of this case, talk about how he had something stolen out of his boat, but only later realized that it could have been anyone. He didn't really know. Actually, he thought it was this white couple who was, you know, sort of living without a home nearby. And so Ruben used the words "arbory" at this point to everyone is a scary mystery to the people involved, and really painted this picture of like, we don't know who this guy is. Like, we think there are crimes happening around here. And he's been coming into the neighborhood at night to look around and go stand on this dock. He repeatedly used the words plundering around, which I guess is the phrasing that Larry English himself described to police officers when he was reporting sort of incidents where people came onto his property. And what we heard is, again, something we hear all the time in cases with police officers doing shootings of Black folks often, is that when Travis McMichael brought out his shotgun, he was trying to de-escalate the situation, which might sound really, really crazy to a lot of people, I think. In what situations is bringing a shotgun out and showing it to someone a de-escalation of a situation? But of course, that's where we come back to whether or not he had law enforcement training. And in these very specific training modules that police officers, uniformed police officers received, showing someone your weapon is supposed to be sort of a lower step than pointing it at them, for instance. But these weren't police officers, and they certainly were not acting that way that day. So we're hearing a lot about that. And again, another police officer sort of argument here is that McMichael feared for his life, feared for his father's life, if Arbery were somehow able to get the gun away from him. And so that's why he had no choice but to shoot, was the argument being given.
Yeah. It's interesting, the law enforcement background and the training that Travis McMichael had at the Coast Guard. I'm sure I can go both ways. Yes, he was trained. And I imagine the prosecution is saying, well, why didn't he use that? And you're saying, well, some worlds having the gun out is a de-escalation tactic. But I can imagine that the prosecution's going to challenge that and saying that getting in two trucks and chasing him is not a de-escalation tactic. And that does not fit what could, even if there had been a crime of theft, that chasing him like that would be an excessive use of force. And they were both trained, both the McMichaels, although I guess Greg McMichael didn't take the full course we said in the podcast, but Travis McMichael apparently was trained in that and actually became a trainer of trainees.
And people might also argue, you know, if you're law enforcement officers, then you should probably know that you shouldn't be getting involved in this. Go ahead and call the people who are actually in the position and have the authority to deal with the situation.
All right.
You love free. And at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/freechecking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
So, of course, we got through the jury selection, which ended in a, you know, had a real surprise ending, right? What can you tell us about the surprise ending?
It did. So late yesterday, Thursday, the November 4th, we heard a motion from the prosecutor who had, you know, been doing the calculations, who had noticed that there were 11 white people on the jury and one black person. And, you know, this is starting from a pool that was fairly representative of Brunswick County. The court had summoned the court had summoned 1,000 people for this jury pool, which is very large for this very small community. And in the end, what really happened there is that so many people in this community have seen the video, have heard of the case, and many people have made up their own minds about the guilt or innocence of the defendants. So there was a lot of an attempt to get potential jurors to answer questions about, you know, would you be open to evidence that this might be self-defense? And a lot of people said no. And a lot of people who were black said no also in a way that I think is very reasonable. But of course, what that means is it's very easy to be dismissed by defense lawyers during the process of jury selection. And so because the defense was able to give race neutral reasons for all of the dismissals, the judge had to deny the motion to reconsider some of those jury strikes.
That was a real shock when people said there are 12 jurors being seated and only one of them is black on a case so supercharged with the question of race, the question of racism. And I don't know where that's going to go, except that, you know, there's some who will speculate it'll lead to a hung jury, a mistrial. Who knows which way this goes? Or, you know, that's not to say white people can't vote to convict, and it's not to say black people can't vote to, you know, exculpate. But I imagine there's a lot of that. This conversation is going to go on for a long time down there.
I think so too, and you know, it's also going to depend on the verdict that this jury reaches. I imagine if they happen to find everyone guilty on all counts, for instance, we might not hear a lot more about this, but it will certainly come up if you know there are acquittals.
That's right. In fact, what it ends up doing is putting the jurors on trial in some way, and the racial makeup of the jury ends up being something that's on trial that people are going to be paying. Because you're right, if this jury, after all is said and done, being 11-1 white, convicts the white men, everyone's going to say, holy cow, you know, and people will start making judgments as to whether the South has changed that much or, you know, because that was not the case for many, many years. There are certain elements from the past that you see, you know, this, the question of whether there's a presumption of black criminality in the way the white men chased Ahmaud Arbery. But no longer do you have an entire system built just on white people in the courthouse, even so.
Right. But of course, I think a lot of people you might hear argue, especially around this case, that this is the way that systemic racism works, is that there are things built into the criminal justice system that without someone, you know, just crossing off all the black potential jurors on a list, you can wind up with an all white jury just because of the way race and the history of race here in the community has affected everyone here. So.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. So I want to talk about some of the testimony today and something that the jury did not hear. And in fact, many people who viewed the live stream did not hear. Some of the live streams cut off when there was not actual activity in the courtroom of, about the case, but were ancillary issues and subordinate issues. And one thing that I learned listening to the first break that took place after Prosecutor Dunikoski's opening is that the prosecution and the defense had previously agreed that the 74-day lag from the time of the killing of Ahmaud Arbery to GBI's entry into the case and the bringing of the charges against the McMichaels and Mr. Bryan was off limits during the trial. It was a subject that neither side could bring up. Listeners of the podcast that we did on the Arbery case know that we spent a lot of time talking about that 74-day lag and everything that happened and didn't happen that should have happened during that time. Did you have a feeling on that, that this it would just be irrelevant to guilt or innocence of the defendants?
Well, I don't know about a feeling, but my understanding is the way that that agreement was reached is that that's not on the defendants necessarily, mm-hmm. unless, you know, it was proven otherwise, how the case was handled. They were allowed to be free and out, and that's what they did. And I think it would extend the trial a great deal more and have really opened up the defense to having to do a lot more sort of discovery and research, right. To sort of defend against that. So the idea is to just leave that out and focus on the activity of the defendants themselves.
Right. So what that means is that they've agreed that names that people have heard either through our podcast or any other, you know, just paying attention, like the name of Jackie Johnson, who, you know, was a district attorney when Ahmaud Arbery was killed and who has since been indicted for allegedly instructing two police officers to not arrest Travis McMichael on the day of the shooting, that's not going to be part of the trial. So anyone who was going to turn to this trial to hear more beatdowns of Jackie Johnson or, debate about her and how and her various controversies, we're not going to hear it. The same for George Barnhill. He's the DA who took over the case from her. She hand-selected him to take over the case rather than doing what she was supposed to do under the procedures that are well-established, and that is to go to the state attorney general and get him to replace her once she recused herself. But Barnhill, who very quickly declared that he thought these three men were making citizens' arrests, they were justified in what they were doing, and his suspicions went more toward Ahmaud Arbery, evidenced by the fact that when he came to order toxicology reports, he ordered them not of the three men. He ordered the toxicology reports on instead Ahmaud Arbery, the victim. What happened today was that we learned for the first time this will not be something we'll be hearing about.
That's right.
So the first day went all the way from 9 in the morning till 5,
close to 5:30, something like that. It was a full regular day, which is actually, you know, the days have been going much longer here through the jury selection process. So it's actually a fairly compact day.
Right. Well, a lot of witnesses still to be heard from, right?
Oh, absolutely. We only heard from one witness today, and I'm not even sure he was finished.
And we don't know how many there will be, do we?
Not yet, but certainly the potential list is quite long.
Okay. And generally, if I might add, just going back to the courtroom, who does get in? Can family members of Ahmaud Arbery getting in? Because we saw his mother. I heard his father was there.
Yep.
You know, the McMichaels family or Roddy Bryan family getting in?
Yes, there. I know that at least the sister of Travis McMichael is there, and there is space for the family members of the defendants there. And of course, there's media and lawyers for the family members who, you know, for Ahmaud Arbery's mother, Wanda Cooper Jones, has a lawyer with her. And same with Marcus Arbery Sr.
So the general public, if anyone listens to this over the weekend and wants to know, can they go down there and stand in line and get in? Are there enough seats for anybody else? Or?
You can try. It is a first come, first served kind of thing. And there are already a lot of people in that courtroom. So it, you know, it's sort of hit or miss in terms of getting in as, okay. as a member of the public.
Okay. Lisa, thank you. It's good talking with you. We'll be talking, I'm sure, as the case moves forward. And I'm glad you're down there. As I said, you're our eyes and our ears. And I don't think we could have a sharper person there doing this. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Hank.
We'll be hearing from Lisa again as the trial continues. This is Barry Truths. I'm Hank Klibanoff.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of mysteries. Are ghosts real? Is that yogurt expired? Hey, the unknown can be scary, but when you donate to WABE, you know where your money is going. Your gift supports the journalism that keeps you informed and the programs that pull back the curtain on complicated stories. Help us make the world less mysterious. Become a member now. Go online to wabe.org/donate, and thanks.